y'all, let's go to Isaiah. Isaiah 40. So it's good to see everybody tonight. Really appreciate Eric covering for class last week. I called him yesterday. A lot of things he brought up I had never thought through. And just loved the discussion that you all had last week. Tonight, we're going to be in the first part of Isaiah chapter 40. Isaiah chapter 40. So I'm going to give you all a chance to turn there. Only reason I messed up tonight, my kids have RSV this week. Y'all heard little Camden on Sunday morning. They've had a pretty rough little week. Jessica got sick this afternoon. I feel fine as of now, but I'm still just wearing a mask because I don't want to spread anything my kids have had to anybody. But it's not COVID. No COVID in the house. I wish my kids had COVID compared to RSV. My nephew had COVID last week and nothing was sick as they've been. But they'll get better. So let's look at Isaiah 40 tonight. Isaiah chapter 40. In Isaiah chapter 40, we are starting into this great, 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 great section of Isaiah 40 through 55. If you had to pick sections of the Bible that are mountains that you need to climb in your life, Isaiah 40 through 55 is in that list. If you had to make a list of places in the world that you had to visit, right, or places in Kentucky you had to visit, we would have a list. If you were to make a list of mountains in the Bible that one should climb before they die, Isaiah 40 through 55 should be at the top of that list. Now, we're going to travel quite slowly through Isaiah 40 through 55, and especially this week and next week, we're going to try to enjoy the scenery. If you notice on the schedule, there's some weeks I'm covering two chapters. This week, we're covering half the chapter because I really want us to savor this text. Now, here's my question. I'd like to ask a nice, simple question as we get started. Who is God? Who is God? I can still remember when I was with another congregation teaching a high school Bible class, and there was one young man who was visiting with his grandparents. He hadn't been to a Bible class, I don't know, ever in his life, 15, 16 years old. And I asked the class this question, and his response was, "I guess God's just some guy in the sky." I appreciated his honesty. He did not know anything about who God was. And obviously, we spent a whole year back in 2017 talking about the nature of God and trying to develop that. And since then, I think that was a great springboard. Thank you. Diving board is what I was coming to mind. I'm like, that's not what I'm looking. Maybe it was a diving board. I don't know. But it was a great springboard for us to, I think, then go to many other places. And indeed, I think if I had to pick a section of the Bible to answer the question, who is God, I would look at Isaiah 40. And I think the New Testament authors are going to look at Isaiah 40 to consider the very nature of God. So that's the question I want us to really keep on the forefront of our minds tonight as we go through this section. Isaiah 40, verse 1. I'm reading from the CJB, if y'all want to go there in your notebooks, okay? Isaiah 40, verse 1. "Comfort and keep comforting my people, says your God. Tell Jerusalem," that's Jerusalem, "to take heart. Proclaim to her that she has completed her time of service, and that her guilt has been paid off, that she has received at the hand of Adonai double for all her sins. A voice cries out, 'Clear a road through the desert for Adonai. Lift a highway in the desert for our God. Let every valley be filled in. Let every mountain and hill lowered. The bumpy places made plain. The crags become a plain. Then the glory of Adonai will be revealed. All humankind together will see it, for the mouth of Adonai has spoken. A voice says, 'Proclaim.' And I answered, 'What should I proclaim? All humanity is merely grass, all its kindness like wild flowers. The grass dries up, the flower fades when a wind from Adonai blows on it. Surely the people are grass. The grass dries up, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. You who bring good news to Zion, get yourself up to a high mountain. You who bring good news to Jerusalem, cry out at the top of your voice. Don't be afraid to shout out loud. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. Here comes Adonai Elohim with power, and his arm will rule for him. Look, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him. He is like a shepherd feeding his flock, gathering his lambs with his arm, carrying them against his chest, gently leading the mother sheep. Isn't that beautiful? Oh, it's beautiful. Okay. I'm going to work us through the questions tonight. Question one. Which passage or passages do you find most beautiful? And there is a right answer.
Oh, really? There's so many.
1 through 11 is the right answer, right?
When you said, answer who is God?
Yes.
That kind of ties in with the verse that I was going to pick. Taking from verse 10 and 11, God, he's the ruler of our universe who wants to carry us open six chests.
Oh, there we go, Kirby. Okay. You already got to it. Let's just answer question two while we're at it. What witness does this text give to God? Okay. Kirby, do you have your CJB open?
Yeah.
Go read for me verse 10. And then Paul can ask you to read a verse. No? All right, that's fine. Ben, will you read a verse for me? Mm-hmm. Verse 11 right after. Okay? Kirby, I want you to read with force. Ben, with gentility. Go ahead, Kirby.
Here comes Adonai Elohim with power, and his arm will rule for him. Look, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him.
He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will carry the lambs in his arms, holding them close to his heart. He will gently lead the mother sheep with their young.
Very good. Okay. I want you all to notice that whenever you consider who is God, Isaiah gives a poetic answer to this question, okay? Isaiah gives a poetic answer to this question, who is God? Now, Kirby, talk through verse 10 with me. Verse 10, how is God figured?
As a ruler.
Good. Hey, what adjectives could we use?
Power.
Right, power, right? Others?
Might.
Power and might. That's exactly the two that I was looking for. Power and might. Now, we have to hold on to this, right? Here comes Adonai Elohim with power. His arm will rule for him. Look. His reward is with him, and his recompense is before him. Now, first of all, do y'all notice, and I want to point this out from a couple of weeks ago, how beautifully the CJB retains the meter of the poetry? Do y'all notice how that beat flows? Look, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him. I just want to point this out, because I'm going to try to keep this thought going. He could have just said, look, God is all powerful and God is almighty. But instead, Isaiah writes, here comes Adonai with power, and his arm will rule for him. Look, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him. Now, that is one figure of God that we see here in Isaiah 40. Okay.
Now, the ruling arm and the carrying arm,
Yeah. Now, we're going to come back to this and talk about what is the reward and the recompense, but I'm going to hold that question off for a little bit. But then, Ben, if you look at Ben's visiting from LA, if y'all haven't figured it out, say hi to everybody, Ben.
Hello.
Hi, Ben. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Kirby's doing like he does with his grandson. It's my child.
Hey, Brian, can I ask a question about verse 10?
Please.
So I don't know the two phrases from the CJB, but his wages are with him and his reward accompanies him. Are those pro-con? Are those opposites?
No. No, not at all.
Are they both positive?
Yes.
Okay. Just want to double check.
Yes. Yes. And I want to close class with that question, Bruce, so I'm not going to answer that now. Okay. But I will get back to that, I promise. Now, verse 11, then. Mm-hmm. What is the figure of God in verse 11?
Shepherd.
God is a shepherd. God is a shepherd. And then what adjectives would we perhaps use to describe the shepherd?
Feeder, nurture, how do you want to phrase that?
Nurturing. I think nurturing. What else?
Protects.
Protective. What else?
I don't know.
Feeder.
Gentle. Yeah. Look. There's a gentleness here. Now, again, I want you to notice this. He is like a shepherd feeding his flock. Do y'all remember how when Mike and I were talking a few weeks ago about the poetry? I can say God takes care of me, or I can say the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Again, we could just say in prose, God is nurturing. But instead, Isaiah raises our imaginations to a heavenly plane for us to envision he is like a shepherd feeding his flock, gathering his lambs with his arms, carrying them against his chest, gently leading the mother sheep. And even here then, there is just even a maternal imagery of God caring for his people with that love. Now, I want to put these two together, okay? What happens? Jamie, talk through this, okay? What if I only envision or imagine a God who is a ruler but not a shepherd? What type of God do I envision?
Like a war god, a warrior god, someone who's overbearing and who just wants to control.
And do you know what the Greek pantheon would call those gods? Right? Artemis. We would have the Greek gods of warfare. Even Baal is of this type god. Baal is this powerful, mighty god who will bring the thunderstorm and drive out the enemies. It is no wonder that every ancient pantheon has a god of war. And this would be the god that would be sacrificed to. God is a ruler. But likewise, if I erase this side of God and I'm only left with this side of God, what type of God am I left with?
A God who lets evil go unpunished and lets the world go on about its way without any kind of direction.
Exactly, right? Well, I mean, this both of these could be making a God in our own image. Now, what Isaiah is doing here in this figurative imagery is holding, I think, seemingly contradictory images together. We're only through imaging God as both ruler and shepherd are we going to truly know God. Okay? You have to have both. Every time we consider the shepherding work of God, we need to understand that the shepherding work of God is actually the ruler of the cosmos. And every time we consider the rule of God, we need to understand he uses that rule not for his own might, but for the gracious love of his people. Does that make sense?
It does. And that reminds me how many men start their prayers is to the Creator and our Father,
both,
who's in heaven. So the Creator lies in the ruler side, the all-powerful, almighty God, and then the Father, the loving, shepherding, nurturing, yes, side of God.
100%, right?
I just keep seeing militant grace.
Say what?
I said I just keep seeing militant grace.
Militant grace. It is. It's militant grace. It's holding. Now, the philosophical term for this is dialectic. It's a dialectic where you're holding two seemingly opposing ideas together. Now, logic alone can't do that. poetry can. Narrative can. Because what the narrative and the poetry is helping us to see is that, again, every time God is ruling, it is for the love of his people. And every time we see him humble, it is the ruler who is doing it. Now, I think there's so many implications to this that we have to let Isaiah define our theology in so many ways, right? Let me use two just as an example. Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and Jesus Christ is Yahweh, okay? Whenever you consider a baby born in a manger, that has no significance at all unless he was first the ruler of the cosmos. The only reason that the manger matters is because the ruler of the cosmos put on human flesh for the sake of his people. But likewise, whenever you read of Jesus cleansing the temple, it's not out of power and might that he's angry at sin, but it's actually for the nurturing grace of his people. Every time we consider an act of God, you have to hold both together. Jessica recently was reading a book that was recommended to her by some other women, and it was all about this question, who is God? And at the beginning of the book, it started with characteristics of God. God is sovereign, God is omnipotent, God is omnipresent, God is omniscient, God is all-knowing, God is all-wise, God is the unmoved mover. And I asked Jessica, what's missing from this list? What's missing from this list?
Love.
There's a list that describes attributes of God, but love isn't in the list. Well, I quickly looked at the references of the book, and I realized she reached John Piper. And I was like, oh, that's why. A few of you will get that. Most of you will not. That's perfectly fine. I'm afraid that so often as Christians, we have just either focused merely on this one or this one, rather than letting them both be held together. Let me get Randy and Bruce.
And you speak of the love. And so that we love one another. We love our family members. We love a lot of people. But it only matters that God loves us because he's the ruler.
Boom.
Right?
Boom.
I mean, just like the manger, it doesn't matter unless it's out of the ordinary.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's heavenly. It's heavenly. Bruce.
I was just thinking about those two sides of God's character and how the Spirit tries to show us that throughout Scripture. It's funny that Isaiah does it so poetically, and we almost have to see it poetically in Scripture to grasp it. And when you were talking about those two sides of God, it reminded me of John's revelation where he literally wept because there was no one in the entire universe who was worthy to open up the scroll and look in it.
Yes.
And an angel said, don't weep because the Lion of the tribe of Judah can open the scroll. And then he looks and what does he see?
Well said. Yeah.
A lamb.
And in Revelation 4 and 5, that narrative that you just mentioned, Jesus is pictured both as the Lion and the Lamb.
Yes.
Both. He's both. Okay. Again, this is challenging, but Isaiah 40 is the foundational chapter of the Old Testament to define who God is. It is quoted in more passages in the New Testament and more of our hymns than I can begin to count. But we have to hold the two together. And what the poem is helping us to do is see God as both ruler and shepherd. Well, this was my main takeaway for class. Kirby went ahead and got us there. But let's get through the details of leading to this point. Verse one. Did you all have questions after listening to the podcast about question four? Which three voices are speaking? Did y'all have questions about that? I'm happy to slow down and talk about it again. If not, I'm going to assume you got it and move on. Any questions about that? And please let me know. I'm more than happy to answer any questions about that.
Okay, so the first voice.
Ryan.
Yeah, let me get Jerry, then Kirby. Go ahead, Jerry.
Okay. When I first read the question prior to listening to the podcast, I thought that we were looking for like three personages, three voices, three people.
Jerry, you are so astute.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, you're so astute. I'll go ahead and answer your question. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for interrupting, but I wrote this like a long time ago. And then Mike and I talked through our episodes after I'd written all this. When I first put this together, I was still convinced that it's three different people talking. I thought it was a particular prophet in 3 to 5, another prophet in 6 to 8, and another prophet in 9 to 11. Mike challenged me on this, and he was right. So if I had to rephrase this, I would say, which three messages are being spoken in the text?
Yeah, that's what I got out of it after I listened, but it was not what I thought going into it.
Oh, me neither. But seriously, I, and Mike challenged me on this, and he was right. This is not three different people talking. All of them is Isaiah talking. He's just offering different voices. Yeah, Kirby.
That was going to be my question.
So yeah.
I'm there. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a poorly written question because at the time I myself needed to be clarified on this matter.
So is it the Spirit speaking through Isaiah then?
I think so. I think that's a very fair way to say it. I think in all three cases, it is the Spirit speaking through Isaiah. But y'all will notice what he's doing here is there's a progression. And if I could say it this way, and this is where Mike really helped me, okay? I still, as much as I try not to, when I read poetry, I think like a debater. I still think like a debater when I read poetry. So I'm expecting main argument 1, main argument 2, main argument 3, and a natural logical progression. But what Mike helped me to see is, no, this is actually three different musical voices that are speaking at the same time. It's like if we could say it in musical terms, it's like verses 3 to 5 is perhaps the melody. 6 to 8 is a concurrent harmony. And then 9 through 11 is another harmony. The tone in what they're saying is a bit different, but the overall message is the same. Go ahead. Thoughts?
Just, yeah,
go
ahead, you're going to make it music, I was thinking of the chord. You got the root, the third, the fifth. And so that's the full triad.
Yes. No, and I think that's what Isaiah is doing here, is it's not bum, bum, bum. It's rather all together playing the same message. Yeah.
Would it be wrong to take the view that it's three verses of the same song?
That's a really good, that's a good thought as well. I like that, Bruce. Yeah, I mean, I like that. I mean, just in simply understanding, it's not an argument that's developing so much as it is verses that are complementing it.
Yeah, because if we were to, let's say we were to call this chapter, this segment of the chapter, a hymn, I guess the title of the hymn would be The Greatness of God Who Comforts His People.
Yes. Yes, 100%. Well, let's talk through these. Verses 1 and 2. Comfort and keep comforting my people, says your God. Tell Jerusalem to take heart. Proclaim to her that she has completed her time of service, that her guilt has been paid off. She has received from the hand of Adonai double for all her sins. Now, question 5, we need to answer. Where is Israel being taken from, and where is Israel being taken to in this text? How did y'all answer this?
Babylon to the comfort of God's selling.
Very good, Kirby. This is where you have to go back and read 39 to get the context here. This is Israel being taken from Babylonian captivity back into the redemptive land of God. Okay? So this is Israel being taken from captivity back to the redemptive land of God. Okay? Now, let me go ahead and answer question six as well. Which New Testament book speaks frequently of comfort? Very good, Angie. 2 Corinthians, the God of all comfort. Now, Brother Stone, is Isaiah teaching about rescue in this text? Keith, that's you.
He's froze up, I think.
No.
Yeah, he is frozen.
Yeah. Hey, Ryan, can I back up to the previous question just for 1 second and and ask this? We discussed this, and we had a little bit more of a poetic answer. Ours wasn't as specific as Babylon to back to the homeland. We answered that God took them from the wilderness to the mountain.
I think that's fine. He's taking them from the wilderness to Zion. You could equally say that as well. Which again, that's not a contradictory answer by any means. Babylon is painted as the dry, arid wilderness that does not have the life-giving presence of God. And Zion is portrayed as the mountain of God enraptured in his love and grace. So perfectly fair answer. Yeah,
six and seven talk about the wilderness.
Yes. Yeah. Ooh, I love this text. So I do want to point this out. If you remember back, this was one of our first discussions. Isaiah points out two problems. He points out the problem of depravity, and he points out the problem of captivity. Okay? Again, he points out the problem of depravity, and he points out the problem of captivity. Now, we've already just discussed the answer to captivity. Israel be delivered from Babylon back to Zion. But notice verse 2. How is the problem of depravity being resolved?
By going with the captivity.
Right. Y'all catch this? Her guilt has been paid off. Her guilt has been paid off. She has received at the hand of Adonai double for all her sins. How is the sin problem going to be dealt with? What's the answer here?
They have to go into captivity, and then the punishment, and then,
Jesus.
Oh, that's right. My next thing, and then go to Jesus.
This is the phrase that is used in Isaiah 53, verse 6.
Yeah.
To talk about the servant paying off the sins of the people. How is the sin of the people going to be dealt with?
Atoned for.
Atonement. Now, pardon. If you look at this term double, it's used in Leviticus 26, 27 to 32. It's used back in Leviticus 7, somewhere in Leviticus 13. And it's all about sin being atoned for. So whenever you consider the whole story of what's going on here, verses 1 and 2 are like the prelude and the forecast to everything that's going to come in Isaiah 43, 55. Here's what Isaiah 43, 55 is about. Israel was in captivity because of their sins, but Yahweh has redeemed Israel to Zion by paying for their sin. Do y'all notice this? Verses 1 and 2 are a summary, a forecast, or whatever you want to call it, to the entirety of what's going to happen in Isaiah 43, 55. Okay? Thoughts about 1 and 2 before I move on.
That is such a tight synopsis summary, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is absolutely beautiful.
And you can you can connect it back to the last study, chapter 6. You can connect that because Isaiah as an individual experienced that.
Yes. 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 Again, Isaiah 6. Eric, make that connection with the atonement idea.
Just how God will provide a sacrifice of atonement that will release us from our debt of sin.
Exactly. Could Israel pay off their debt?
No.
No. Israel could not pay off her debt. Only God providing the sacrifice could pay off the debt of the people. And that's what Isaiah 53 is all about. Other thoughts? All right, well, let's keep going. Verse 3. In verses 3 to 5, what's going on here? Why are highways moved? Why are mountains leveled? Why are valleys raised? What explanation did Mike give for this? I thought he did an excellent job in explaining this.
I think the first comment, clear a road, is what we're seeing here. Clear the way, make it easy for folks to get to this promised land.
Exactly, right?
Transform the land.
It's a transformation of the land because who is coming?
The Creator.
The Creator. God Himself is coming. Listen to this. This is from Deuteronomy. Adonai came from Sinai. From Sinai, he dawned on his people, shone forth at the mount, and with him were myriads of holy ones. At his right hand was a fiery law for them. He truly loves the people, and all his holy ones are in your hand, sitting at your feet. They receive your instruction. The way of the Lord that is described here is about God coming to give help and aid to his people. Now, again, we need to notice this.
Without fail.
Yes.
Because of the way it's all laid out.
Yes. Israel was in captivity. Israel was under the hand of the oppressor. Israel was enslaved to Babylon. However you want to say it, Israel, because of their sin problem, was in a situation they could not overcome. So how is the solution going to be provided? God will make a way for his people. And y'all, isn't that just a beautiful image? Bruce, are there any songs that have been sung in the past about this verse?
A lot.
Yeah. I know the Lord will make a way for me. It's all about this idea. And what I love that song, what that song is all about is, whenever it feels as though there is no path forward, God is going to open up the way. And that was his promise. And I think we need to understand this. Within antiquity, you didn't hear of a people taken into captivity going back into the land. That's just asinine. One thing I learned about Henry Clay whenever I visited last week was he tried to make Lithuania a place for enslaved African Americans to go back to. It failed miserably. there was generational divides and it didn't work. And in general, you would not hear of a people who had been captors to then go back and be victors in their homeland. This is like the underdog story of underdog stories. But who is the one who's going to do this? The one who is both ruler and the one who is both shepherd. Now, verses 6 to 8. Obviously, I love these verses. A voice says, proclaim. And I answer, what should I proclaim? All humanity is merely grass and all its kindness like wildflowers. The grass dries up, the flower fades when a wind from Adonai blows on it. Surely the people are grass. The grass dries up, the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. Isn't that so easy to memorize? The grass dries up, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. Memorize that verse. It's so poetically simple. The grass dries up, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. I could talk about these verses for hours. What thoughts do y'all have about these verses? I don't want to spend 20 minutes on them. So what thoughts do y'all have?
That was one of the other verses when you said what verse is your favorite or what struck you. That was, you know, what should I proclaim? The word of God stands forever.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's the word of our God doing this. The only thing I do want to
I love that the Spirit and the Son.
Thank you. Thank you. Right. This is Trinitarian, right? This is fully Trinitarian. The word of our God, Jesus Christ, the Spirit of God, the Holy Spirit, the breath of God being sent by the Father. This is so utterly Trinitarian. And it shouldn't surprise us that the New Testament authors go back to Isaiah 40 and Isaiah 42 more than any other passage in the Old Testament to try to understand the Trinity. So then verses 9 to 11. This is now Zion herself, the mountain, proclaiming, here is your God. Here comes Adonai Elohim with power, and his arm will rule for him. Question 7, which Old Testament moment does the arm of the Lord recall? Which Old Testament moment does the arm of the Lord recall? What did y'all get for that?
Exodus.
The Exodus, right? The Exodus. Kirby, what did the arm of the Lord do in the Exodus?
In 6:6. The part of the sea so you can get through.
Yes, right? The arm of the Lord separated the seas so that the people could return. And y'all, do y'all notice how the story of the Exodus is this story here? Israel captive in a foreign land, being brought back to the land by the arm of the Lord. Okay?
Led through the waters like it was a highway.
Yes.
Yeah, smoothed it out, same way.
Yes. Hank, I'm sorry, I just saw your question. Yes, Jerry and I will be in touch with you, okay? It's a miscommunication between her and me that I will take full responsibility for. Great. So, yes, I will be in contact.
That is too much to say now. The ease of it all. Yeah.
So what?
It's so much the same as Isaiah. You know, the flattening of the mountains, the smoothness. It can be,
making a highway, path, just like he did through the Red Sea.
Yes. Sorry. Red Sea. I wasn't sure which you're talking about. It's the exact same thing, right? Which, I mean, Eric told the story last week. I'll tell it this week. This is God rescuing his child from the wilderness, bringing them back to the mount through his gracious love. Which event is that? Let me say that again. This is God redeeming his son from the wilderness, bringing them to the mount by his gracious love. Which event is that? Eric?
Sinai.
Which event is that, Randy?
The cross.
Which event is that, Kirby?
A bunch.
Isaiah 40, right? I mean, it's the same basic narrative in all three cases. God redeeming his people. God redeeming his people from a captivity by bringing them back. He is the one who alone has the power to do that.
It's even the story of the end time.
It is. Yes, Revelation will draw upon this in Revelation 15 especially. There's all types of Exodus imagery all over Revelation 15. The other thing that I do want to note here.
Brian, it's even in every individual's coming to his kingdom.
Here's where we need to go. Let me come back to that in 1 minute. Okay. Now, Otis made a comment to me personally, but that I want to focus on here for a second. In the Exodus, not only did the arm of the Lord redeem his people, but the arm of the Lord also judged Egypt. This is important to note. The same arm that saved Israel was the same arm that judged Egypt. Now, here in Isaiah 40, the same arm that is redeeming Israel is the same arm that is judging Babylon. And then at the cross, the same arm that is saving God's people is the same arm that is judging Satan. So we have to see, and as I explained in the podcast, I think verses 6 to 8 are ultimately offering a judgment upon Babylon. Your captors aren't going to last. I will outlive them. Later sections of Isaiah 43, 55 are going to pick up this theme and bring it to full strength. But there is this judgment of evil that we have to hold in this text. Okay? Now, before I run out of time,
but it seems that is there, but it's subdued a little bit.
It is.
Because he wants to concentrate on the hope that's coming, right? Yes. And not on the other side of it, which the first 39 chapters really on Assyria was mostly based on how they would be judged.
Yes, 100%. Right. Yeah, 13 through 29 are all about that. 13 through 29 are all about that in the book of Isaiah. And absolutely, Randy, this is where I would call it a subtle theme here, that when you get to like chapters 41 or chapters 45 and 46, it's going to become a theme that becomes stronger there, but there's definitely subtle hints of it here. Go ahead, Kurt.
But it is implied, and maybe because... You know, maybe because people don't get implications of the scriptures sometimes is why we think, well, God's just a God of love. God's just a God of love, which he is. He's a God of love, God as well. But, you know, people that I know, you'll wonder how could a just God, you know, be angry? How could a just God punish, you know, because they're not getting the other implications that come along with the whole story.
100%. Yes, well said. Well said. And I think that you have to go back to always to this. Why is the wrath of God revealed? The wrath of God is not revealed because God is bloodthirsty. The wrath of God is revealed to redeem his people. And I've offered this challenge before, and I've never found a verse that doesn't fit. Every time the wrath of God is revealed, it is for the sake of saving his oppressed people. Every single time the wrath of God is revealed, it is for the sake of saving his oppressed people. The Greek gods demanded blood sacrifice to appease their wrath. God's wrath is simply for the sake of redeeming his people.
Release on ungodliness and unholiness.
Say what?
It's release on ungodliness and unholiness.
Well said. Well said. Well said. Explain that a bit more, Eric. I know where you're coming from there, but explain that a bit more, please.
Just how the wrath of God is presented and brought forth so that evil can be subdued and God's wrath becomes victorious over the powers that enslave the people he loves.
Yes, well said.
You can go to the temple. You know, when Jesus went to the temple, people like to say, well, did Jesus sin there? Well, why did that happen? Because he was helping the oppressed people that were being taken advantage of.
There you go, right? And
God wouldn't be loving him just if he didn't release us from the ungodliness and sinfulness that holds us captive.
Yes.
And so his wrath has to be revealed against the ungodliness.
Yes. Yes, well said.
And him in his father role in that moment. I mean, how would you react towards your children being unjustly treated?
See, and it's like Fleming Rutledge has really helped me with this in the crucifixion book. Because the only people that don't understand the importance of God's wrath are the people that have never experienced oppression. If you've experienced oppression, you know, yes, the powers that be have to be judged for salvation to come. And Isaiah 43:55 is going to be all about this. God's rule over enemies does not come because I am God, you have sinned, therefore I demand punishment. No, it's because your adversaries have to be judged, and through that judgment, you will be saved, and I will nurture and cherish you. So it's very important that I think Isaiah helps us to see this, because it is. It's a very important concept for us to understand of God. Yeah, great thoughts. I didn't expect to go down that rabbit hole, but great thoughts. So now we get into the final question tonight. Anything else before I offer my final rabbit hole?
Are you talking about verse 10?
I am.
Okay.
I am. Let's talk about verse 10. What is the reward? What is the reward? Do you have your ESV, Randy?
I do.
Go to Psalm 127. Eric, read for me Isaiah 40, verse 10.
Do the CJV or the ESV?
Do CJV for me.
Okay. Here comes Adonai Elohim with power, and his arm will rule for him. Look, his reward is with him, and his recompense is before him.
Psalm 127. So I thought for a long time, what is the reward in this text? So here, God is coming. He's entering into the suffering of his people, not to rescue, but to redeem them, and to bring them to the mount. What's the reward in this text? Well, if you look at the full range of meaning of reward, and I think contextualize what's going on here, it becomes a bit clearer. Randy, read for me Psalm 127, 1 through 3. Many of you will recognize this psalm immediately. Psalm 127, verses 1 to 3.
Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sheep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward.
What is the fruit of the womb?
Children.
A?
Reward.
Reward! Anybody see a connection between those two passages? What's the reward in Psalm 127?
His adopted children.
His adopted children.
Yeah.
Okay. Heath, take it for me. You know where I'm trying to go.
I was saying that, yeah, our adoption as his children, that's the reward.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Our redemption.
Yes. Now, if you look at the word recompense, Bruce, it's used in similar ways in the Old Testament. The wages or reward of our labors. Now, so much we could get from this, but let's finish here. Eric, what does it mean to labor?
I guess to invest yourself towards an end goal.
Okay. Now, if I were to ask Lauren, what is labor?
Yeah, it'd be different.
What would Lauren probably say, Eric?
Like childbirth.
Oh! Do y'all notice that even in English, we have this shared, this dual meaning?
Never thought of that.
Labor is all about reward. But what is the ultimate reward of laboring? A child. When the ruler of the cosmos comes down and deals with evil, what will be his reward?
We're adopted by his spirit.
We who are adopted by his spirit. Look, his reward is with him. And his recompense is before him. I want y'all to understand this image. The image of this passage is Zion, the mount. This is Mount Zion being, it's a poetic device, anthropomorphism. It's where you take an inanimate object and give it animate qualities, okay? It's telling the mountain, mountain, look, here is your God. Here comes Adonai Elohim with power. His arm will rule before him. His reward is with him. I think my shout just made the security alarm go off. Is what it did. Look, his reward is with him. His recompense is before him. The image of this is the ruler, the king, leaving captivity. And what is with him, Jamie?
His children.
His children are with him. This is the ruler who comes. And when he leads them back to Zion, what will he do? He is like a shepherd feeding his flock, gathering his lambs in his arms, carrying them against his chest, gently leading the mother sheep. That is our God. Eric.
Because of what I look through for the connection between power and spirit, I mean, I couldn't help but see, like, here comes Jesus Christ with power, with the spirit, and his arm will rule for him. Look, his reward, like that spirit of adoption is with him, and his recompense or his means of amends for your suffering and for your loss is before him. And just think of the throne room, how the spirit is always before God, before the Lord.
Yes.
That was just so spiritual.
It is. And it's like, it's this image of the Son. I mean, let's just get fully Trinitarian here. This is the image of the Son by the Spirit leading a people back to the Father and presenting them to the Father. Here is your reward.
Here are my brothers and sisters.
I
are your children. Yeah.
You gave of your only Son. Here is your reward, my Father.
Think about that. That we are the reward. Yeah. I mean, think about how God honors his children, right?
Live it, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is reshaping. Now, Lois asked me to talk about question two. Y'all, I'm sorry. I knew there was no way I was going to do this in 50 minutes. What witness does this text give to God? By witness, I mean, what does this text tell us about God? Well, it tells us that God is both the ruler and the shepherd. And ultimately, I think it's telling us who will come through the revelation of Jesus Christ. But question three, who does this text call us to be? Last week, Isaiah 6 calls us to be
dedicated.
Love it. Dedicated witnesses to God. But now, what does Isaiah 40 tell us that we are? His children, his children, his reward. That is who God has revealed us to be. All right. Thoughts? I can go in for another hour. I love Isaiah 40.
Just real quick, the question number eight. Were the mountains, were you thinking about the obstacles in 3 and 4 and then Mount Zion, the other mountain?
Yes. And I do think that there is a pun here about every other mountain will be leveled. Every other mountain will be leveled.
So there's a way from every side.
Yes. Yeah. There's nothing preventing everyone of all nations coming to this mountain. And then if everything else has been leveled, what is then the only